It's cold. We are in Berlin. And it is season 2, episode 22 of the Linux Voice podcast. And quite a different one this time, isn't it, Graham?
Yes, it is, Mike.
Yeah. Andrew and Ben are not with us. They will send in their discoveries later, hopefully. But, yeah, who do we have here sitting opposite the table?
Hi, I'm Leonard Petterling. I'm one of the developers of Systemd, and I work for Red Hat.
How cool is that?
Thanks very much for joining us, and thanks for all your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's really good to have you here. So, Andrew would normally say we have news, finds, no neurons. We've got a good voice of the masses. And he'd also say something about buying the magazine because...
Oh, that was right, yeah.
That's something we do with a little bit more professionalism than the podcast.
Yeah, if you like this podcast and want to pay us to be able to travel and meet people like Leonard, then...
Was only Ryanair.
It was, right, yes, well, Air Berlin for me, but... shop.linuxvoice.com. So without further ado, let's get into the news. The biggest news item, and we'll talk about this, it's also in our voice of the masses, is the Debian fork, Dev1, or however it's supposed to be pronounced.
It's supposed to be Italian, so it's Il Devon or something.
Nobody can really tell at this stage how true it is, how real it is, whether it's just some people joking around or...
So this is a fork of Debian.
This is a fork
where
of Debian.
They want to remove all traces of Systemd.
Well, they say they want to have init freedom, so they will have other init systems.
Well, I think it's more complicated, actually, because there are already two fractions, as I saw. Like the one that wants to remove Systemd entirely and the other one that just wants to make it optional.
Right.
So somebody needs to set up forkdev1.org very quickly.
Probably, yeah.
The thing I found hard about it is it's very hard to find out who's behind it. I've been in the IRC.
They're supposed
channel.
To be senior maintainers of Debian, aren't they?
Apparently, I mean
500 of them.
500 veteran Unix admins. I've emailed them. They have an email address on the Dev1 page. I'm a Linux journalist. I'm just curious about this. Can I speak to somebody? Not an answer. I asked in the IRC channel who's behind this, and I got pointed at one sort of email message on a mailing list with somebody from Debian sort of backing it. But I think it would be have a lot more legitimacy if
two of the guys are actually public now with the names. Like on LWN, there was a discussion where somebody figured out two of the names, and it's actually not that hard because they link a GitHub repository, and if you go onto that, then you can actually see the names of the committers, and they're two Italians.
Now, Leonard's a real journalist, then. Yeah. I'm going to work that out.
I was curious too.
Yeah.
We did have a crazy deadline last week in our excuse, which was... Yeah.
Well, yeah,
anyway, it's done now. Yeah. Yeah, the next issue's out.
Right, so having a couple of actual Debian developers behind, I mean, it's still very small compared to the rest of the project, and yeah.
And I guess we'll talk about it more when we come to the Voice of the Masses, but it is big news. I mean, I haven't had I can't remember a distribution fork on this scale since Mandrake or Mageia and that kind of thing happened.
Yeah, well, I guess Mageia came about because Mandrake died.
For different reasons. Although there was the community fork happened when the company basically became a private concern.
Yeah.
So it was the old maintainers and contributors who wanted to keep up the community side of it. It was before it actually went past.
Yeah. I mean, there are always different reasons, but if you look at Ubuntu, for example, in a way, they're fork too.
That's true, that
it's
yeah.
Not
yeah.
a fork created out of... rifts in the community, but more about making something different, right? Like, it happens all the time, I think.
Yeah, there are countless times it's happened, and we've talked about forking quite a bit recently as well. It's interesting it's actually happened when we've been discussing it so recently.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people said that's part of the strength of free software and open source, the ability to fork. Whether people will follow you or not is another matter, but...
You know, two groups of people working on exactly the same project, I think, is often a waste of energy, but, you know...
I mean, I kind of enjoy the fact that they... actually do something about it because I think people who always complain and don't do anything are much worse than people who complain and then actually do something. That's certainly preferable.
I agree, and at least then when you're judging things by what people have done, it's just easier to be pragmatic and, you know, have a proper conversation about the pros and cons of one thing over another.
And I think competition can actually be a good thing, right? With Systemd nowadays we have no competition anymore, right? Like because like the closest to competition was Upstart, and it's kind of not developed anymore. And then there's Solaris SMF, and it's progressing in really, really slow pace. And now there's this other fork, like the UselessD fork of Systemd.
Oh, yeah.
And while I'm pretty sure they'll notice that many of the choices they made will probably not work out, I kind of enjoy the fact that there's at least people who do something, right? Like, and if it would be successful, that would be fantastic, because I enjoy competition, because we can actually learn something from them. We can steal features from them.
Yeah.
And like, for example, FreeBSD is now going in a similar direction, doing their own thing. That would be fantastic, because I'm pretty sure the FreeBSD people with their own systemd-ish, launchd-ish thing could create a lot of stuff that might be interesting for us in systemd to steal and to get inspiration from.
Yeah, that was a huge contentious issue for them as well. It's like,
yeah, that's always sort of worthy of a little news story in itself. FreeBSD's Jordan Hubbard gave a speech on the status of the project in the next 10 years, and basically said we also need something like systemd, not necessarily taking systemd, but we have similar challenges that we're going to need to fix somehow. So I think that's quite interesting, given that loads of people, at least vocal people on Slashdot and the likes, anti-systemd, say, right, I'm moving to FreeBSD, I don't want to see this, and then one of their guys says we need something different. Right, let's moving swiftly on. Firefox 34 just came out like a few hours ago or something, didn't it,
as we're
recording this, and it's got Firefox Hello in it, which is WebRTC video streaming, and you just click a button and it immediately gives you a link that you can send to somebody, and then you have an immediate video stream with them, and it's supposed to work in Chrome and Opera as well.
We must try it, because here in Berlin we were talking to the FSFE just yesterday, and one of the things we were talking about is an open alternative to Google Hangouts, which most of us use, and we've all used WebRTC, and the thing is that sometimes it works and it works well, but you can never rely on it, because sometimes under the same conditions it just doesn't work. If the latest version of Firefox makes that easier and it works, then that's a good thing. It's also the first one with Yahoo as the default search engine.
I presume so, yeah. I was looking at some release notes for
it. I thought they only did that for the US. I think the non-US version is still default to Google.
Really? But I thought the decision would affect it worldwide. But
no, there are different search engines in different territories, aren't there? So probably different timings for different releases in different areas.
Because one of the other features as well is that in the search bar, when you search Wikipedia in the States, it will submit your request over HTTPS, but that's only in the States. So I can't work out why that wouldn't apply everywhere.
No, why not enable it everywhere?
Yeah, who knows?
Might be legal things that some countries have different restrictions there, I don't know.
Presumably, but you can access HTTPS Wikipedia here easily enough in the United Kingdom. So
yeah.
It's also got a new live theme previews thing, I guess. Not many.
Does it still break every plugin that was released previous to last week?
Oh, man.
You know, I always found it interesting that back in the days, themes were the great thing about Linux, and then every app having, like, every user who had his Linux installed had a different desktop and different style and things like that. And nowadays, you realize that, people actually start having themes for apps and stuff, and I totally, and like on Windows nowadays, every app looks different, like this uniformity that we had on Linux kind of goes away if you use, like, I don't know, it's so weird having theme.
Yeah, because even LibreOffice can now use these Firefox personalities, can't they? So you can have your, and some anime background to your LibreOffice. But it also includes this new web IDE tool as well, which includes a
Oh, yes, that is good.
It's got a Firefox OS simulator built into it, so that could be good for, you know, eventual larger adoption of Firefox OS, if everybody can start trying out their sites and apps.
Yeah, I think, in fact, Ben reviewed it for issue 11, didn't he? Or he reviewed the web IDE part of Firefox.
Firefox Developer Edition, yeah. Moving on to a bit of laptop news. A group is trying to crowdfund a completely free laptop, as in, it doesn't need any binary blobs for it. This is the Purism Librem. The crowdfunding campaign has 28 days left, and so far they've got $41,000 of the $250,000 they require. We're in a coffee shop, by the way, listeners, so that's why you can hear this. But it's interesting, the BIOS isn't free in it, so it's not free as in, like, Richard Stallman's tiny remote laptop or... the machine starts from $1,449. That gets you a Core i7, 4 gigs of RAM, 500 gig hard drive. It doesn't sound amazing specs for the price.
What precisely is open source about it? If it's, it has a Intel processor and Intel firmware and Intel everything, so what is open source?
Yeah, I mean, they're saying it can run the Linux Libre, is it, the kernel without any binary blobs, but
that's easy. I don't run any binary blobs on my machine.
Yeah, it's still using the BIOS.
It's still, they said we're going to try and work with the upstream manufacturer to free the BIOS code, but
I just thought that would have been one of the most important things.
Yeah, you
know? I mean, that's
really difficult because like Intel ships out those EFI binaries nowadays for the most low-level stuff of the BIOS, and even if you have a board manufacturer, he will not have access to those things. They get them in closed form from Intel. So if you want to make a really truly open device with an Intel processor, you actually have to convince Intel itself to open up certain things, how they initialize the processors, and I don't see that coming.
Mm. Yeah, so it's a bit hard to see the point of it, really. I mean, yeah, if it was free as in Stallman approved, then that might be pretty cool. But and also HP have announced a new EliteBook laptop that's going to ship obviously with Windows, but we also have a choice of Ubuntu or FreeDOS.
Where did that come? Is that just to avoid paying for a Microsoft license?
I think it was some requirement. It had to have some sort of operating system.
You have to sell it with an operating system.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't open it at a security airport.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe somebody will genuinely buy it who really likes DOS.
Well, it's the best way if you want to install a pirated version of Windows. Or you get the FreeDOS and then replace it, right?
Yeah. Or play Frontier or whatever.
That's the first I've heard of HP releasing a laptop with Linux, though.
Yeah, I mean, they might have done some sort of developer machines in the past.
Like Dell?
Yeah, and a lot of companies have tried or had, you know, sort of small ranges of Linux laptops.
But
never really been in it for the long run, so... Yep, those are the main news stories. Anything else strikes you as happened?
Like the Docker thing, the Rocket thing, did you see that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't read much about it. Maybe you can explain more about
Docker, as most probably know, is like the big thing in containerization. It's like probably the most talked about project in the last year or so of open source. Mm. And let's say there were some issues with governance, I guess, of Docker, and now a company called CoreOS has done their own Docker replacement. They called Rocket, and so Docker for the first time has some serious competition by people who can really pull it off, I think, of being a competition. And they like I don't know. I think the criticism about Docker there was that the company tried to keep a very tight control about the Docker name and enforcing trademark and things like that, so that they would stay in control of this super popular thing that Docker is. And I think the Rocket guys from CoreOS, they kind of want to be the open alternative and provide a better implementation that is open to everybody again, like how Docker initially used to be. And I think if somebody can pull it off in establishing a competition to Docker at this point in time, it's probably them. So I'm looking forward to getting some movement in there, so that it's not just Docker, but Docker and Rocket and a couple of others maybe. So I'm looking forward to that. I think it's a good move.
Mm. And as we were saying earlier, it's competition is probably the most important thing.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, the CoreOS people, I mean, I'm personally sympathetic to them, of course, because they, in CoreOS, like one of the core components, and since day one, and they announced that, make that public, is a systemd, of course, and hence I kind of always voting for that camp. Can't be sure about that. So looking forward to that. I mean, and from a systemd side of things, I really would love to have good integration into those containers, so that both systemd can be running inside of the containers very nicely and out of the box, and can run outside of the containers really nicely, and still everything's integrated. We try to do that with Docker. Let's say not everything we wanted actually was implemented, but if the Rocket guys do this, and I think this is really, really good for the Linux platform as a whole, because if CoreOS pulls that off, then we'll have container implementation all the way through the stack, interfacing with operating system itself, and I think that's just a good way how to have a unified system.
So it's now Finds of the Fortnight.
Oh, yeah. My favorite section.
So this is the section where we talk about things that we have found, which we never ever seem to get around to finding anything. Hopefully Ben and Andrew will send their finds over, because Mike and I have been a bit pushed for time. However, by the way, I did actually discover something while writing a quiz, a pub quiz for the last issue of the magazine.
Oh, the Linux pub quiz, yeah.
Yeah. And that is that Mark Shuttleworth, of Canonical Ubuntu and Spaceship fame, is helping restore botanical gardens in the Isle of Man, where he now lives. Now, Canonical's always been registered as in the Isle of Man.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's not for tax reasons whatsoever. but even I think I first noticed it on Mark Shuttleworth's biography on his own Here Be Dragons site. And he said, today he lives on the lovely Mallard Botanical Garden in the Isle of Man. And then I did some Googling for this, so you can look up like the local newspapers in the Isle of Man.
He lives inside of the botanical gardens? Is he a flower?
Well, I think there must be, so the news story is planners have approved application for a botanical garden of global standing and worthy recognition. Mark Shuttleworth, the first South African in space and multimillionaire founder of the Ubuntu computer operating system, is the brainchild. 32 hectares, Mark Shuttleworth's botanical garden in the Isle of Man.
Says he's a billionaire there, but yeah. I'm sure he's not a billionaire. Well, billionaire
businessman and philanthropist, Mark Shuttleworth.
Some currencies, probably.
Yeah, maybe in Rand. So I think that's incredible.
He's probably going to bring a lot of South Africa onto the Isle of Man, right?
Yeah. I haven't seen him recently, but it'd be great to talk to him. And
we should try and interview him again. We've interviewed him on a podcast before that won't be named, but
this is, you know, I think it sounds like quite. I've been to the Isle of Man, and it's a really nice place. So I mean, if it was a botanical garden that was otherwise just going to go to waste, and I think it's going to be open to the public. That's how it sounds. You know, that's my find of the fortnight. Anyway,
excellent. Oh, well, I don't think I can top that, but. In the last podcast, I noted that I came across an Arnold Schwarzenegger-inspired programming language. So all of the instructions are based on quotes from his films. So obviously, it's a bit like pseudocode, like BASIC. To return from a subroutine is "I'll be back," pretty much. So I had to look around for some other obscure programming languages, and some listeners might have heard them already. But there's Whitespace. Whitespace.
Oh yes, yeah.
A programming language consists of tabs, spaces, and new lines, and that's it. So it's quite interesting if you got printouts of that. Malbolge as well. I don't know if you ever heard of Malbolge.
No, I've not heard of that.
Malbolge was designed to be the most complicated programming language in the world, and it's so.
It already exists in C++.
But it's so complicated that the first program wasn't written for 2 years in the language, and that program was written by a computer performing just basically searches. So yeah, hello world in this language took years and years and years because it's just so horrendous.
That's not bad.
Sounds like a challenge, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Rewrite macOS in Malbolge.
And we didn't give Leonard any advance warning about this, but I mean, is there anything that you've discovered in the last few months that, you know, you were our geek desktop for a previous issue of the magazine?
Yeah, issue 10.
So was it the GNOME desktop that you used, or what is it that you really rely on that's a really good kind of piece of open source software? Or not, if you could see how he's looking at me now.
Well, I mean, of course I use GNOME 3 all the time. That's the only desktop environment that, yeah, it's like the best one at least. But I use Emacs a lot.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Emacs.
Yeah.
Well, I'm one of those old time guys who uses Emacs. But I also use Vim a lot. So I'm actually agnostic, right?
So was Emacs the first editor that you used? Is it just...
Oh, no. Well... No. Like MS-DOS 6.2 edit.com.
Right.
That was my first editor. It was beautiful. And actually, the one, QBasic one, which was kind of the same editor.
Yeah, I remember that. Awesome. I remember that.
Yeah, I thought it was the same thing, basically.
But I used a lot of editors in my life, like and then MC-Edit, if you know that one, like the editor of Midnight Commander.
Yeah.
And then I learned Emacs and Vim at the same time, and I still use both.
Do you like live in Emacs like a lot of people? Do you do all your mail in it and
No. I mean, it's a good editor, but. Actually, I've write my emails with Emacs, but not within Emacs, right? Like, I use Mutt for mailing.
Okay.
And then when I actually, you have to integrate an editor in that, that is actually Emacs for me.
Why do you need a window manager at all if all of this stuff's on the
Well, I mean, there's something that needs to run my web browser and my terminals. But I don't know. I love GNOME 3, and I work with the people who design it, and I know that some people like think it's controversial, but I think it's actually fantastic and the best thing that we ever had, and it's like the first thing that ever can compete with was macOS. But even then, I probably spend most of my time between Mutt, Emacs, and the shell or something.
Yeah, and a web browser. I guess that's probably me as well most of the time.
Which shell do you use?
Oh, Bash. I try to stick to the defaults.
Can use ZSH?
Well, I don't know. I hear it's better, but then again, I mean, I kind of try to stick to the defaults, right? Like, for example, I run GNOME, and I don't have any extension installed, right? Like, because I think it's, you know, I'm a developer, and I'm supposed to eat my own dog food, right? Yeah. And hence, I think it's a good thing to be exposed to the operating system the way it was intended to be used by the developers, so that I can actually suffer the same way as users can suffer. So I don't know. I think it's really important to not leave the path of the suggested solution too far to your own thing, because then you don't know how it will feel for other people who are newcomers to the operating system. Not all fits together.
Do you screen or tmux or something like that, or do you just have all the windows open at once?
Well, I use a graphical Emacs usually for developing, okay. But I have this server on the internet where I do all my mails, and they have screen in there,
right.
But only to keep an IRC session open all the time continuously, so that I never have to log off, and it runs IRC, but it's like IRC is the only thing that run in screen.
Right.
Other than that, I just use. Yeah, Mutt, I start when I need it, and I don't keep it running all the time. And I know that people nowadays use tmux, but I must say
I've never looked into that.
I use tmux, yeah.
Tmux is supposed to be better than screen, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really use that many particularly advanced features of it, but tmux has a nice sort of little taskbar thing at the bottom, you can see which programs are running in the virtual windows. But
I must admit, I lose track of my screen sessions, and it's only when I do screen-r I realize I've actually got 4 or 5 sessions.
25 sessions.
I've just been detaching. Yeah, yeah.
Or it's screen sessions set up by somebody who's hacked your machine.
Yeah. Okay, well, at this point, we'll go and listen to Ben and Andrews. Hopefully, they've sent them.
I've got a couple of finds this fortnight. The first is actually an old find that I've rediscovered recently. I don't think I've mentioned it in a podcast before, but it's that you can use an Android phone as a USB Wi-Fi modem. The reason I found this out is in my office, and the Wi-Fi point quite close to me was down for whatever reason. We needed to connect to one of the next office over. And I'm just connecting via a little USB Wi-Fi dongle, tiny little one that plugs into the back of my computer. And that the aerial on it wasn't good enough to pick up the Wi-Fi in the next office, but my phone could. This is an Android phone. What you can do is connect it via USB, and then I forget which menu you have to go to, but if you go into one of them anyway, there's a tethering option. And USB tethering, click enable, and it will share the Wi-Fi connection over USB. Some Linuxes will just pick this up automatically. Ubuntu did. Arch naturally didn't, so I had to configure that one manually. It also works in Windows, which is really handy because Windows doesn't recognize that USB dongle. I've never got around to getting the drivers for it. I've used it a few other times as well, actually. It's handy for a Raspberry Pi. If you don't want to go out and buy a dongle, you have to. You can use your phone if it's just for a couple of projects. As I recall in Debian, there is a little bit of setup involved, but I'm casting my mind back now. I can't quite remember. I think you have to start a DHCP server on the Pi to connect to the phone. I forget. I'm sure there's instructions on the web somewhere. My second find this fortnight comes from a smart TV I'm trying to build. Basically, we've got an old telly, and I've got an Android development board, Udo, which is, it's a quad-core ARM jobby, similar to a sort of more powerful Raspberry Pi. But it's got an Arduino on as well, which I actually won't be using for this project. which is a bit of a shame. But anyway, back to the smart TV. Got Android installed on it, Netflix, iPlayer, that sort of thing. And all set up on a monitor just to test it was all working out. And it was all going fine. Playback was fine, everything like that. Then it was time to switch it back to the TV. Now, the problem is a TV doesn't have a digital input. So I had to use the analog one, the sort of the three cables RCA. So I needed a HDMI to analog converter. Now, I know these aren't brilliant at the best of times. So I didn't hold it. I knew there was a reasonable chance it wasn't going to work. But I got it all plugged in and it seemed to be working fine. At least it was at first. After about a day or so, it just went completely. The sound and the video were all out of sync and there were all sorts of wobbles and issues like that. And I tried all sorts of things, tried changing the resolution, tried everything I could think of basically, and it just wouldn't work. And I was pretty much ready to give up. I'd been going at it for quite a few days, trying different things out. And I took it all apart and I was like, right, I'll just do something else. And I thought, well, I'll just give it one more go. So I plugged it all back together, turned it on, and it worked. And I hadn't done anything. I thought, I just couldn't understand how it had worked. So I sort of went, I thought back through all the things and what. And I realized I'd never powered off the HDMI to analog converter. For some reason, it had been a glitch in the software. And that was the problem. I'd cycled the development board and the TV. But this this converter had just remained plugged in as I fiddled with everything else. And it just didn't occur to me to restart this. And as I said, I was completely ready to give up. I'm not really sure what the find is. I guess it's that to make sure you really test each and every bit of something before giving up when it's not working. It's not a great find. I guess my find is that HDMI to analog converters can work if you're patient with them and try powering them on and off. And they're a great way of reviving old TVs and a much cheaper way of getting a smart TV.
And they were our finds of the fortnight. So moving, would this be the point place for a halfway reminder?
It would be, but we're probably about 70% of the way through anyway.
That's traditional, isn't it?
That's traditional,
so, yeah. So this is the halfway reminder still to come. We have the voice of the masses and the end.
So the voice of the masses this episode is the DevOne system default, Debian fork, a good or a bad thing? Obviously, we never say forks are bad things to have, but is it been well thought out? And so, yeah, Javier says it's too early to know. All they have at the moment is just a not particularly nice website. The fork could be a good thing in the same way that LibreOffice was a good fork. Frankly, I don't have the technical background to know if systemd is a good idea or not, but I feel that many distros, including Debian, are going too fast. It seems one of these things. Have to be tested a lot before installing them in your computer. It's not a text editor that you can substitute easily. Corbin says, I think forks are a great thing, essential in the open source community, as many others have stated. The Debian fork might be a place for systemd haters to vent their passion to. I think there's an interesting point there as well. Hopefully this fork will let both sides go on in peace now. So the people in Debian who don't back systemd, they've got somewhere to go now instead of just arguing on the mailing list all the time.
Yeah, because there's been a lot of words said and very little action. Just reading here, Steve Newbury says a fork of Debian is going to be a huge undertaking, and I think that's what most of us think. It's like, do they really realize what they're doing? You know, yes. How much effort goes into Debian? You know, it takes that long for a reason.
I would really trust them more that they're going to be successful if there were actually more Debian developers actively involved and would actually be leading that. Then I would say they have a good chance. But looking at the people who are doing it, it really sounds like they're not the people who have experience with actually running something like Debian. And it cannot be underestimated how much work that is actually putting together a distribution. And keeping it running for a long time, and then keeping the security updates coming and things like that. There's so much bureaucracy, so much work you have to do for that. So many people, like good people, who will do backports of security fixes and things like that. It is. I don't know. I would personally never fork a distribution because that's not the amount of work that I would like to.
I mean, yeah, we were talking before. I can't think of a time when it's happened at this scale, and all for these reasons, you know, because usually there's the community that inherits or was already central to the development of a distribution anyway, so they know what they're taking on.
Just think about the amount of infrastructure they need to put up now. Like, they need to create all the build machines and then set them up and maintain them. And
maintain them, that's the thing. I mean, they're going to have to keep on doing this.
Well, they're probably good at that after all the old administrators, they say, the veteran Unix administrators. But still, it's so much work. One shouldn't underestimate that you have to maintain a bug tracking system, the build systems, not just a couple of websites. It's real infrastructure. And at Fedora and at Debian, there are lots of people involved with that, really good people. And before you can compete with that and actually have the same level of quality of service there, you actually need all those really good people around, and they don't grow in trees, so
no,
unfortunately not. So
Paul Dan, I guess that's Paul Gideon Dan, says they're scratching their own itch, which is perfectly reasonable. As has been pointed out before, if there's sufficient demand for another init systems, people will step up and maintain them. Personally, I'm really happy with systemd, so I'm not too fussed.
I'm happy too with systemd.
finally, the question.
We found someone.
One of the two.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the other comments that came up. I mean, in general, people are saying, forking is an inherent part of free software and open source.
I think the comments that we've had have been pretty constructive. I mean, unlike a lot of the other comments that exist on the internet, you know, once again, there's an awful lot of sanity, and I think people want to give it the benefit of the doubt. Okay, if they're serious, then let's see what they come up with. You don't want to, you know, they may come through on something, but of course it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a horrendously difficult job. So I'd like to say I'd reserve judgment, but at the same time, I haven't seen any evidence that they know what they're getting into.
Yeah, I think if it had been 20 or 30 Debian developers who all come out with you know, all their names and said, we're doing this, and it might be a bit more than just a sort of semi-anonymous website. So.
Yeah, I mean, I personally have some issues with this kind of anonymity that they're trying to achieve. That sounds like it's not very grown up in my way. I mean, there's a, like the way I see it is, like, usually if somebody sends you a patch or something in an anonymous, like with a code name, it's usually an indication that it's not going to be, like, my experience simply is that the people who do all the work usually are so proud or something of the work that they're willing to give their names on it. And if I see the contribution without the name, I always have the suspicion, okay, let's have a closer look at what it actually is before I trust that it's actually going to be something good. So if I see that's kind of anonymity that they, like, I think two people now made their name public, but everybody else didn't. So, I mean, either they don't exist or they do exist, but then I don't really know why they want to stay anonymous. I don't know.
Well, I think they might say, well, it's because we want to avoid getting part in yet another, you know, having loads of hatred thrown around.
If you do work, then you need to get out in the public. There's no way around it. Like, if you actually want to work constructively and the work is in the center of what you want to do, then there's no way. You have to engage with people, and engaging with people in a completely anonymous way, that's not, but I don't know, I wish them the best, certainly. Like, from my perspective, I kind of enjoy if people actually do something and not just talk.
And you like competition.
I mean, they're not directly competition to systemd in a way, right?
No, but in the Linux ecosystem.
Yeah. I think it's not a bad thing. But then again, I mean, I don't think that they will be successful in the long run. But if they are, then I would love to be convinced of the opposite. What we'll see about that in a couple of years.
Yeah, Carl Knapf has a pretty good comment. He says, sure, it's fine to fork. Let's see where they will manage it. So far, I have seen two people on IRC investing work, about five making angry jokes about Leonard, 30 or so flaming systemd by parroting slogans found on the internet, and 300 hanging out and enjoying the show. On the other hand, there are people volunteering their time, service, and energy, but without the basic infrastructure in place, it is hard to do much, so we will have to wait and see how many are still interested interest to once actual work is to be done. I'm a bit shocked that anybody that has shown any understanding about systemd was asked to leave for trolling.
Is that true? I mean, I hadn't, until I read that comment, I didn't realise that had happened. That's not very democratic.
No. I mean, yeah. Trying to put forward technical arguments. Do you think that wraps it up?
yeah, you're right. It's been half an hour. So, yeah, thanks very much for joining us, Leonard.
And thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for contributing. I don't know. Is it difficult to try and? I don't know what I'm trying to ask here, but does it still feel like your project when you see people like doing this and it creating such kind of huge waves in the community?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when we look at that, like take a step back and then figure out, oh yeah. My God, what did we actually do? Like, were we the triggers for causing a big split inside of the Debian community? I mean, I used to be a Debian contributor myself a long time ago before Red Hat. I mean, like, I was maintaining actually my own software inside of Debian. I wasn't a Debian developer, but a Debian packager, but I kind of like, I mean, it used to be my community. I wasn't too active, but it was my community. So, but I don't know, I think I wouldn't take the responsibility for these kind of things. It's like, we try to stay technical with what we do and then try to convince people in a technical way. And if, like, our involvement with Debian in the last years was like, I mean, people sometimes claim we would pressure them into anything. But I don't know. I never post on the mailing list or anything like that. I never, like, I work together with the people who actually maintain systemd in Debian, and a couple of us went to last year's DebConf in Switzerland. I did a talk about systemd, and that's pretty much everything there was, right? Like, we thought it would be a nice thing, a gesture to show that we're interested, but then again, we never try to push anything on them.
Yeah.
So I think it's in many ways, we make them an offer, and if it's convincing, they should take it, and if they don't think it's convincing, so I don't think, like, I should take the blame for
split, right? No, absolutely not.
But of course, it's still like, kind of course, if we weren't there, they wouldn't be under the pressure and that they are under. So I'm sorry for that, of course, but and again, we just make an offer. I think it's a very convincing offer, and apparently it is, because they adopted it after all.
But, and everyone else has adopted it.
Yeah, but I mean, this is something actually that I wish people would think about more often. It's like if they think, oh my God, why do all the distributions adopt it? They should realize that there are probably technical reasons for it, and even if they disagree, it might be worth figuring out why all the technical committees adopted that. But then again, yeah, I don't know. I think in general, it's. I never expected in my life to have that much influence on anything. And you know, when I started with open source, I didn't even know if I would be working in it. I couldn't really believe that this is something you can do. And nowadays, we're standing here and are at a central place. We have some influence, and it's sometimes weird being in that position. But we try to be nice, though, even if people don't really realize that so much.
Maybe that's a good way to end it as well. I mean, the vast majority of people, all the open source people I've met, like 99.9% of them are all incredibly grateful for all the hard work that's done on their behalf. And it's a great, positive community, and, you know, long may it continue. So we'll see you again in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks' time, I think we're all going to be together. So it'll be like the last podcast of the year.
Oh, a Christmas podcast.
It'll be a Christmas podcast. So maybe we'll go to the pub. We're all planning to meet up and have some of my homebrew, which is just about being finished right now in the garage. We'll see you all then.
What kind of beer is it?
It's actually it's using an American IPA recipe. I've got a real taste for the really strong hoppiness. So it was fermenting for 5 weeks, and I just bottled it last weekend, so it really needs another 4 or 5 weeks to condition, but I should open a few bottles just before Christmas to see what it's like. It's about 7%, really strong hoppy beer.
What's your favorite beer, Leonard?
Well, like next door is actually this place that sells really good Helles. Like, they have a very good selection. You know Helles? You know Helles.
Yeah,
you
live in the light Bavaria, lager beer, yeah.
It's like it's a really good lager beer, like a little bit sweeter than Pilsner, but that's what I like. I mean, around here they usually have Czech beers and Helles, like from Franconia. And yeah, I'm all for Helles always.
Excellent.
Excellent. Okay, so that's it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.